Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a timely free resource with you. When you look at the headlines, war, instability, constant talk about the end times, it's easy to feel anxious or unsure what to think. But the Bible offers a better way. Our short guide, Watchful, Not Worried, End Times, the Second Coming, and How to Read the News with Biblical Hope, will help you understand what Scripture really says about the end times, so you can live with clarity, hope, and confidence instead of fear. You'll discover how to read the news through the lens of Scripture, avoid speculation, and stay grounded in God's bigger story. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to say that we've got a guest on the show again today, which is Tim Cross. How are you, Tim?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to see you.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. I should have really given you your title, Major General Tim Cross, brackets retired. I'm not 100% familiar how to address retired senior officers of the British Army. Tim is just fine. Doesn't sound on ceremony.
Sir, yes. I was once a cadet pilot, and the most important thing is just salute everything that moves.
Well, Tim doesn't stand on ceremony, which is a huge relief. But Tim, would you mind briefly introducing yourself and sharing a little bit about your background, how you joined the army, and where your career took you?
Sure. Let me start by sharing my favourite quote, which I use a lot when I give talks and things. H.G. Wells, reputed to have said that the professional military mind is by necessity an inferior and unimaginative mind. No man of high intellectual ability would willingly imprison his gifts in such a calling. And that's me. And to a large degree, it's true, actually. Although I should add that H.G. Wells met Stalin once and left thinking he was a nice bloke, apparently. So we may not need to take him too seriously. But I actually was not very intellectual at school. I left school with two O-levels, as they were in those days. And all I ever wanted to do, really, was join the army. I didn't come from a military background. I joined the cadets when I was 13 in 1964, so barely 20 years after D-Day. Went to an army sixth form college, went to Sandhurst, and was commissioned after a couple of years there in 1971. And I left in 2007. So man and boy, it was 43 years. And it sounds a bit pathetic, really, but I loved every day of it. It was a fantastic life, fantastic career, and served in many interesting places we may come back to. Left in 2007, and I now run my own company, which is a portfolio of business, academia. I'm a lay minister in the Church of England, and I do a lot of speaking engagements and work with a couple of charities.
Brilliant. Well, we'd love to dig into some of that just now, as you say. Were you a believer when you first joined the armed forces?
No, I suspect, like an awful lot of people listening to this, I would have thought and would have believed. I came from a Christian family. I had a very happy childhood. My father worked for Shell. We lived in Australia for a while. We lived all over this country. Dad retired in 1962 when I was 11, and I went to a Church of England primary school. I'd been baptized. Christine and I were married in 1972. A couple of children baptized in those early 70s. And I would have said to people that I was a Christian, but frankly, Jesus meant not an awful lot to me. So we were, I think today the expression is cultural Christians. So I became a Christian in 1981, actually. and tell you that story if you'd like to hear it. And so I was a captain. I was then 30, and because that's when I became a Christian, and that's when I made a decision to become a disciple of Christ.
Had you come across Christians in the armed services before you found a personal faith? And because there were army chaplains, and it was a fairly big thing of the British Army, isn't it?
It
That
is.
sort of organized religion.
Yeah, it is. And in the 1960s, of course, everybody understood the military. It was a large organization, much larger than it is now. A lot of army, well, army and navy, air force chaplains. So yes, I got to know a lot of good chaplains. I had some good friends who were Christians. When I was commissioned at Santa, well, actually at college, we had a very good chaplain. We had a very good chaplain services in the chapel. It was all boys. Sandhurst was all men. The academy chapel is brilliant for in all sorts of ways. And I was confirmed at Sandhurst, which is quite peculiar, really, quite unusual, and I'm not quite sure why. Looking back, I think it was just part of the spiritual journey, if you like. But I was very comfortable amongst Christian friends, and as I say, would have called myself a Christian. But in the context of where I am today, I realized that that was, not. I hadn't become a disciple of Christ. I mean, I hadn't given my life, in inverted commas, hadn't been born again, to use Jesus' expression in John's gospel. And so therefore, it was a transformational change.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because I understand it was while you were on leave in Jerusalem, is that right?
Yes, it was. It was. I'd been commissioned. I'd served in various places, and I was doing a tour with the UN in Cyprus. UN peacekeeping operation that had been going on since the 60s and is still going on. And I was working in the headquarters at Nicosia, and it was Easter coming up. I managed to get a couple of seats on a UN aeroplane, a flight. The UN in those days had UN operations in the Golan Heights, in the Sinai, in Jerusalem, and in obviously in Cyprus, various other places. So it wasn't that difficult to get a couple of seats. We left the children with some friends, and basically just flew to Jerusalem for a weekend away as tourists, really. We arrived on the Easter, on the just before Good Friday, and went to places like Bethlehem and walked around and so forth. Easter Sunday, we went to the Anglican Cathedral. And went to the Easter Sunday service. And over a cup of coffee after the service, a chap came up to me, welcomed me, and introduced himself, and just said to me, had we been to the Garden Tomb? I'd never heard of the Garden Tomb, and but he did describe where it was. And I did recall, actually, the previous day having walked past a formation, a big rock formation that looked like a skull, which therefore, I was able to go back and find it. But the first thing to say about that is, to encourage people who are listening, you never know what's going to come out over a conversation over coffee. I mean, that conversation changed my life and Christine's life and indeed our whole family. So anyway, we went that afternoon to the Garden Tomb. It's outside the old city wall. It's next to this rock formation that looks like a skull. It has a first century tomb, a first century wine press. It is a garden. And the guide that day was a retired British Army colonel called Dobby. And there were a number of Dobby members of the Dobby family who were military Christians. And I was a young captain. So a God incident, really, that the guy that day was this chap, this retired colonel. And we walked around and had a look and so forth. And then he sat me down, opened up John's Gospel, chatted it through, and then said, look, because of the accepted place for the crucifixion is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre inside Jerusalem. He said, look, I this may or may not be the place where Christ was crucified. I happen to believe it is, he said. But he said the most important thing is if you go and look in the tomb is empty. Now this was Easter Sunday. It was my 30th birthday actually that day. And feeling a bit of an idiot, I got up and walked over to this tomb. I'm not quite sure what I expected to find. But I leant on the entrance and I just found myself thinking, this is a pretty important question actually. As Paul says, if Christ didn't rise from the dead, then all Christians are to be pitied more than anybody. But I found myself thinking, well, if he did, I better go away and give this some thought. A great friend of mine, a chap called General Ian Dury, who was a wonderful Christian man, commanded the artillery brigade in the First Gulf War. I served with him there and various other places. Ian used to say that most men in particular become Christians by traveling on the M1 or the M2. I don't know whether you've heard this expression. The M1 is the Damascus Road, one M in the word Damascus. And it's a heart-driven emotional response to meeting the risen Christ, as Paul did, obviously, on the road to Damascus. The Emmaus Road is the two M's. And the Emmaus Road story, of course, is when Jesus meets the disciples returning home after the crucifixion. And we're simply told the story that he opens the scriptures and explains to them what happened and why it had to happen. So it's a head-driven, intellectually in inverted commas, as opposed to a heart-driven passion, experience. Now, it's not either what just one or the other, but I am an M2 man, is the truth. And I would say, going back to our earlier conversation, that thus far in my life, I just spent spiritually, I'd spent my life going around the M25, going nowhere. And I realized I needed to get off. Either to say he didn't rise from the dead and therefore I should forget about all this, or if he did, I needed to do something about it. And so I went back to Cyprus. Christine, my wife, became a Christian before I did, by attending some Bible studies with a padre and a very good Christian friend of ours who we still see regularly. Actually, he became the vicar of my local church at one point. And I took a bit longer. I talked with him. I read the scriptures. I prayed. And then one day I just said to myself, come on, get off the fence, make a decision. And I frankly, I think blokes need a challenge to do that. And I think they often need men to challenge them to do it. And Mark had done that to me. And in the end, I said, okay, Lord, I'm getting off the fence and I will stand with you. I want to become your disciple. So, it was a long period, but it was, as I said earlier, transformational.
I bet. And did you have any sense then that becoming a Christian would have any relevance for your day job in the army, or did you see no kind of challenge or conflict or tension there at all?
No, I mean, almost immediately I had to tackle the issue. So yes, it's a question I often get asked, could you stay in the military having become a Christian? And I had to study the scriptures. I had to speak with friends. I mean, Mark, who I referred to earlier, who subsequently left the army to get ordained, but other people too, chatting to the chaplain and just reading the scriptures, studying the scriptures. And there are lots of references I could use here, but the first one is when John the Baptist is baptizing people. He meets Or a bunch of soldiers go to see him and ask him what must they do to be saved. Now, this is an occupying power, soldiers of an occupying power. He doesn't tell them to leave. Actually, it would have been almost impossible for them to do so anyway. But what he does say to them, which I've always felt is a bit unfortunate, is be content with your pay. And I think what he was saying to them is don't abuse your power, don't run protection rackets, and that sort of thing. Jesus meets a Roman centurion who asks for his servant to be healed. Again, we're talking about an occupying power, a centurion, a serious senior player. And in the end, Jesus says, okay, I'll come with you to do this. And the centurion says to Jesus, no, you don't need to come anywhere near my place. I'm a soldier. I tell people what to do. I tell them to come here and they come and I give them orders. He said, all you need to do is give the word of command and my servant will be healed. And Jesus extraordinarily really turns to the people around him and says, I've never met faith like this anywhere in Israel. I mean, it's an extraordinary statement. You've then got P Peter going to Cornelius. And so, if there's something fundamentally wrong with being a Christian in the military or being in the military, what's going on there? So, I came to the conclusion that God needs Christians everywhere. He needs them in politics, in economics, in business, in academia, in the church, and he does need them in the military. And I often say to people who challenge me on this, would you rather have an army that has no Christians in it? And finally, it was maybe a bit more controversial, but I'm not convinced Jesus is a pacifist, actually. I mean, clearly there, he's not in favor of, doing nasty things. But when we read Luke's gospel, early on in Luke's gospel, I think it's chapter 8, he sends the disciples out on that first missionary journey. And he says to them, don't take any money, don't take any spare jacket, just get out there, preach the gospel, heal the sick, raise the dead, etc., etc. Luke 22. The final supper, the last supper in the upper room. Jesus talking to them in Luke 22 says, do you remember when I sent you out? And they say, yeah, of course we do. He said, well, I'm telling you now, amongst other things, if you don't have a sword, sell your jacket and buy one, sell your cloak and buy one. And one of the disciples says, we've got two swords here. And Jesus says, that's enough. Now, I've debated this with, a lot of good friends, including pacifists. But if Jesus is a pacifist, what's he doing allowing two swords in the upper room for the final communion, as we now call it? And what's he doing allowing them to carry those swords into the Garden of Gethsemane? Because we know they do, because one of them uses a sword to chop off the ear of one of those coming to arrest him. So this is not the time. But my conclusion was, we all live in a broken, fallen world. Evil and sin are not interesting theological words to me. They're a reality. I've watched the mass graves being dug up. I've seen what people do to each other in these conflicts that I've been involved with. And I think we need to stand for justice and righteousness. And as we need a police force to deal with burglary and criminality in the UK, some pretty nasty hoods. In my time, people like Milosevic and Saddam Hussein, but previously people like Stalin and Hitler and Mao and Pol Pot and, you know, the rest of these guys. So I'm not saying it's an enjoyable thing in inverted commas, but I think it is a necessity of being part of a broken, fallen world. And in the end of all of that, and it was over several months, I said, OK, I'm going to stay. And the question was, OK, if I stay, how now do I live my faith out as a Christian in the army?
Because I guess it wasn't, as you say, it wasn't theoretical for you, because within a few years you would be deployed to be fighting against Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
Which, as you say, this is a deeply evil person who's used chemical weapons on his own people, invaded another sovereign nation, sponsored terrorist threats and more. Did that feel, I don't know what the word is, not righteous, but there was a sense in which, right, this is that theology coming alive for me. I'm using force, but for a holy, just cause.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, I've, you know, clearly I've had this conversation with a lot of people over the years, and I you know, God calls people to do different things. I think he doesn't call everybody he doesn't call everybody to join the military. But the other thing I did at this time was to study people like Joshua. Now, you know, there's a lot of conversation we can have about the way Joshua conducted the campaign plan to secure the promised land, and clearly it was pretty brutal in many respects, and we just got to acknowledge the reality of that. But the night before, Joshua, of course, crosses the River Jordan and prepares to take on the first battle of what will be about 40 battles to secure the campaign plan. And that first battle is the Battle of Jericho. And we're told in Joshua, I think it's chapter 5, chapter 6, that he's walking alone before the battle and he meets a man dressed in armor. And I think he asks this bloke a very sensible question. Are you on our side or are you on their side? And the person we know from the reading was the angel of the Lord, says to Joshua, no, neither. But as the commander of the Lord's army, I have now come. And cut a long story short, Joshua falls on his face, takes off his sandals, and says to this angel, what are my Lord's commands? And we can easily, all too easily, forget that he then receives the most ridiculous battle plan that anybody could possibly come up with. When he's about to conduct a siege of a major city, he's told to march around it a few times, blow a few trumpets, and everything will be fine. So he has a choice to make. Do I do that? Do I follow what I'm being told? Or do I plow my own furrow, if you like? Now, you know, there are lots of conversations we could have about that story. But for me, the message I received from that was that God is not a murderer. Whether God is on my side, he's not an Englishman or an American or any other nationality. The question is, am I on his side? Am I doing this to secure justice and righteousness? And, you know, that's literally, I then found myself thinking and actually believing I am no longer the commander in chief of my own life. You know, I am a man under command and I have to try to do best I can to serve in the way that, you know, that I'm being called to do. And in a similar vein, you've got people like Gideon, who is summoned to take command, you know, of the Israeli army to fight the bunch of Midianites, who are a pretty brutal bunch. And Gideon asks God a very sensible question. Are we going to win? And God says, yeah, you'll win. It's fine, Gideon, you'll be fine. But there's a problem. Your army's too big. And if you remember the story, Gideon is told to assemble the army and say to the people, it's an army of about 32,000. And Gideon's told, assemble the army and tell them, if you've got something better to do, you can all go home. I have to tell you, I never tried this with my brigade operation. But 22,000 of them look at their watches and think, all right, time for tea, I'm off. And he's left with 10,000. God then says, still too big, Gideon. Take him down to the lake to drink. And those who lap the water like a dog, send them home. And those who lift the water to their mouths, you can keep them. Quite a good military principle, if you think about it, actually, because if you're lapping the water like a dog, you're not watching what's going on around you. If you're lifting the water to your up to your mouth, you are. 9,700 of them drink the water like a dog. He's left with 300 people out of an army of 32,000. And he then fights a brilliant maneuver warfare battle, in which basically the Midianites slaughter themselves. It's in the book of Judges. So the message that I got from that story is the message that Zechariah talks about, which is not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. This is not about earthly numbers or earthly power. This is about God's spirit being with us and alongside us in the choices and the decisions that we make. So I wanted to try and lead as a military commander in that sort of way, recognizing that I needed to be on God's side and I needed to be working alongside him through the power of his Holy Spirit. That sounds terribly, deeply spiritual. And of course, we failed on that on all sorts of occasions. But there were several times in my career where that was very clear to me and I did my best to hold firm to it.
And of course, just fast forwarding to the current time, there was a period, wasn't there, when particularly after the fall of the Berlin Wall, where it looked as though everybody was talking about the peace dividend.
Yeah.
That, we were no longer going to need massive militaries. There was going to be, much, much greater international stability. Whereas it seems very much now that we're in very dangerous times, doesn't it, from a geopolitical military perspective?
Yeah, I think that's right. Post-Cold War, 1989, the Cold War comes to an end. And very quickly, this major peace dividend is being sought by governments who want to switch the spending to welfare and to other things. Understandably so. But and of course, the great end of history speech, Huntington and Fukuyama, the end of history, and all the world is going to become free and capitalist and liberal democracies and so on and so forth. Well, the reality is that just has not happened. I mean, the majority of the world now lives under pretty brutal dictatorships or authoritarian regimes. Democracy is under real pressure. And I think Western democracy is under real pressure for all sorts of reasons we might come back to. So we do live in a broken, fallen world. We live in a world where we've seen a whole series of wars since then. I mean, immediately after the end of the Cold War, Iraq invaded Kuwait, of course. And I was part of 1st Armored Division that deployed under a UN Security Council resolution. So it was a legal, internationally legal war, and that went very well. But I do remember leaning on a Land Rover on the road from Kuwait City to Basra, waiting to hear whether we were going to go on beyond the border with Iraq to continue to defeat the Iraqi military or indeed to get rid of Saddam Hussein. The decision, I have to say, I think rightly, was that we shouldn't. But that all choices in life carry consequences individually and collectively. And the consequences of that decision was that Saddam Hussein stayed in power for another 12 years, gassed the Kurds, drained the marshes, killed. Well, certainly tens of thousands of people died in those following 12 years until we then went in 2003. In those intervening years, there was the terrible atrocities in Africa, in Burundi and where all the 800,000 people were killed.
Rwanda.
In Rwanda. There were the terrible atrocities in Rwanda, 800,000 people killed, not using modern weapons, but using machetes, basically. And then there were a whole series of Balkans wars, which I was involved in three of them, initially trying peacekeeping, but that didn't work. So we had a NATO force that deployed. We put in a peace enforcement operation in the Balkans, in Bosnia. And then in Kosovo, of course, one stage we were bombing Serbia. And my brigade, I was commanding a brigade then, and we got involved in all sorts of other things. Again, we might come back to, but we do live in a world of, I think, more uncertainty. It was a very bipolar world in those days, a Warsaw Pact versus NATO. That's not the case today. And we do have this business of pretty awful leadership. Putin, President Xi, I don't want to point fingers at Western leaders who seem to be pretty hard. And anti-democratic, but that's the world we're living in, and I think we have to recognise the reality of that.
Mm. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about how, as you said, you went on this journey as you became a Christian and became convinced that there was there was a calling indeed for some believers to kind of take up the sword, metaphorically speaking. Does that become harder and harder when you're involved in conflicts like the Second War in Iraq, which wasn't a kind of clear cut like the First Gulf War? There wasn't an overwhelming international legal justification. The rationale around WMD turned out to be false, and we got kind of bogged down as the West in this kind of democracy building anti-insurgency conflict that a lot of people, at least civilian people, felt was something we should never have been there in the first place. How do you reflect on that?
Yeah, it's well, clearly it's an important time. I think we're living with the consequences of that today from Iraq in 2003. But let me just set a bit of context to that. I was involved in Kosovo, as I say, and my brigade built and ran refugee camps in Kosovo for various reasons. And that was the first time that I met Tony Blair when he was Prime Minister, and various other people, Clare Short at DFID and so on. Blair had given this speech in Chicago about the fact that we in the West, democracies, could no longer just stand by and watch as people massacred their own people, as in Rwanda, killing 800,000, and as it happened in the earlier stages in the Balkans with ethnic cleansing and all that had gone on. And he felt pretty passionately about that. And the UN then adopted a policy which they called Responsibility to Protect. It was known as R2P, Responsibility to Protect. And Kosovo was the first time that that was really put into play. And it has to be said, it was a success. And I think Blair felt that he had been justified in what he said, and that you know, we did have a responsibility to protect. 2001 then happens, which is obviously, you know, a major change in thinking. I always thought it was wrong to declare a war on terror, but that's what America did, and everybody sort of gathered around that. And the move into Iraq in 2003. And the preparation for that was in 2002, and I was involved in that in various ways. Is a, you know, one's got to see it in that context, I think. One's got to see it in the context of the first Gulf War, the intervening years, what happened in the Balkans, Rwanda, the Kosovo deployment, September the 11th. And I've got no doubt at all, and I know people have the strong views about this, but I've got no doubt at all that Tony Blair genuinely believed, first of all, that he had to stand alongside the Americans. Because, you know, grand strategic politics and et cetera, et cetera. And secondly, he believed that the Americans would sort this out and it would all go reasonably well. But he also felt that, yes, there was a threat of WMD. Most governments acknowledged that and said that they did believe it. And I think Blair did feel that it was time to do something about a pretty brutal regime. Now, it clearly did not work out that way. And I was in Baghdad. I did various things beforehand. I was in Washington, and then Kuwait, and then I went into Baghdad as the military campaign came to an end and the statue came down. You may remember that famous picture of the statue coming down. And I lived in Baghdad through to the summer and watched this whole thing go pear-shaped. And it was strategic failure. And I now lecture on failure, actually, because of those experiences. It was a pretty searing experience. And I came back from there emotionally, physically drained and spiritually drained, actually, for all sorts of reasons. So I have to say, though, that I don't have a problem with having seen the back end of Saddam Hussein. What we failed collectively to do was to properly think through post-war Iraq. In the same way, there's a real danger that we're not, you know, we, the West, President Trump, are not thinking through what happens post-war of the current campaign in Iran. And Afghanistan, which had started very quickly after September the 11th and had been quite successful with the deployment of relatively small numbers of special forces in particular, and Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of State for Defense in America, you know, planned that and executed it and believed it went well. And his decision about how to fight the Iraq campaign was all based on the fact that he thought it would go very well and very quickly the Iraqi people would throw off everything that Saddam stood for. But also in Afghanistan, then the decision was taken to deploy to try and get a new government in place and you know, put a democratic government in place in simple terms. And we, the UK, found ourselves with a brigade plus in Afghanistan and a brigade plus in Iraq, and we couldn't sustain that. And the West as a whole didn't have the strategic patience and was not prepared to put the time, the treasure, and the talent into making those two theatres of operation work. And the honest truth is, the harsh truth is, we pulled out of both of them, and the consequences of that have, I, in my view, have been very, 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 you know, bad.
And so you, as a senior military officer, you are of course totally dependent on the politicians who ultimately decide. And so when you find yourself in a position where you honestly think the politicians have got it completely wrong, but you're, because of the line of command, are having to do things that you fundamentally disagree with, I mean, how do you reconcile that with yourself as you're grappling with these kind of issues?
I mean, you're right. I mean, I didn't wake up one morning and decide to deploy my brigade to the Balkans or, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm a member of the armed forces of a sovereign nation with a democratically elected government, and it is the government that makes the choices and the decisions. And I am, you know, under authority to then do my best to you know, make those decisions work as best I can. And I'd never had a problem with this. I mean, in Northern Ireland, I did bomb disposal work in Northern Ireland in the 70s and did some other stuff out there. I felt that, you know, dealing with the IRA and indeed the UDA, UBF and the Protestant organizations, you know, that was the right thing to be doing. We were trying to secure an environment in which the politicians could sort out the problem. I never had a problem with that. I never had a problem with UN peacekeeping or the Cold War or the first Gulf War or indeed any of the Balkans deployments. The truth is I never had a problem with 2003 in the sense that I did feel that it was right to try, that we should try to do something about this pretty brutal regime. I never knew whether or not they had weapons of mass destruction, but it was, you know, it was, I think we tended to forget that an awful lot of other governments did think that this was probably the case. And Saddam Hussein, of course, was pretty unhelpful. So, you know, I never felt that this was fundamentally flawed. My daughter actually was one of the million people that went on the streets of London. So, you know, this was not an unthinking process. I was having various conversations. Mm. But the simple truth is, in a position that I was then a major general, you are at a point, in simple terms, where you either say, I'm going to do my best to make this work, or I fundamentally disagree with what I'm being asked to do, I'm going to have to resign. I never felt that I got to that place. I did know somebody who pulled out of, who resigned over the operation in Northern Ireland to gather up a whole part of people and put them in jail without trial. You may remember early on in the 70s. And I wasn't deployed in Northern Ireland then, but he was, and he fundamentally disagreed with that. And he resigned over it. He was a relatively young lieutenant. But I think you have to, you know, you have to recognize that, as I said earlier, I think I said earlier, all choices carry consequences. And I'm very reluctant to criticize prime ministers, presidents, foreign secretaries, people in power who are having to grapple with really difficult choices. And whatever choice they make, whatever decision they make, there will always be people who don't agree. That's part of leadership. You're always going to be surrounded by people who don't agree with you. And you have to press on to do the best you can. So for all of the criticism of Tony Blair, and I understand that, and I certainly didn't agree with all the political decisions he made for various reasons, but I think he genuinely believed this was the right thing to do, and he tried to push it through. The sadness is, I think he doesn't regret it in the sense that he says he doesn't seem to want to admit that it didn't go well, which is nonsense, really, and very silly, I think.
If you've ever struggled to fully understand the New Testament or explain your faith with confidence, you're not alone. That's exactly why Premier Insight exists and why your support matters right now. When you give today, we'll send you a special thank you gift, the New Testament You Never Knew Bible Study Guide by N.T. Wright. It will help you understand the context, meaning, and story of Scripture more clearly. And your support helps others do the same through programs like this. So please give your best gift today and request your copy. Just go to premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. Thank you for helping people engage God's word with wisdom and understanding.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, the kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson. And in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premiere Unbelievable.
It's an interesting analogy with medicine, where you, again, you know, as a senior doctor, you've only really got one option if you disagree very strongly with what's going on, which is to resign. But you can only resign once.
That's quite.
and therefore, you've really got to ask the question, you know, is this it? Is this the point at which I walk away entirely? Oh, and of course, what that means is that my possible influence for good is lost. So I really need to that, you know, I in my career had certain red lines where I felt, you know, if the government insists that we now do euthanasia in newborn babies, and this is legal and starts happening in my unit, I'm not going to be able to participate. I'm going to have to resign and find another way. But thankfully, it never came to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it never came to that for me in that stark sense. And I'm not sad to see the back end of Saddam Hussein. That's the truth.
Few would be.
Yeah,
well, I mean, I kind of came of age in this kind of war on terror. It was kind of very much during my teenage years. We were involved in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it was, I think it produced a generation that's quite jaded on the idea of that kind of utopian responsibility to protect kind of late 1990s vision that you sketched out earlier, that I think people my age often feel much less, much more cynical about the possibilities of using military force for good. And I think you see that in the preceding 20 years, there's been far fewer attempts to kind of deploy Western forces against the numerous bloodstained dictators out there, and much more a reliance on air power and missiles and bombs, as we're currently seeing in the Iran conflict. I'd love to know your reflections on that kind of shift, this attempt to kind of, you know, peace build from 30,000 feet, as some people call it. You know, is that a delusion? If we actually want to do something meaningful for the people of Iran, do we need boots on the ground like we tried to do in places like Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah. Well, again, you know, there's lots of issues there we could tackle. I mean, and it, you know, those two deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan did change the thinking. We still, of course, tried to do something. Well, we did in Libya. We got, you know, Gaddafi was forced out of power. There were lines drawn as a result of all of this, though, in places like Syria, where President Obama said the use of chemical weapons was a red line and, you know, we'd have to do something about it. And in the end, he didn't. And David Cameron had the debate in Parliament, and Parliament voted against us being involved. And that, again, was all as a result, I think, the inevitable and understandable pushback against what had happened. So people are very reluctant to put boots on the ground. I personally don't believe, and never have believed, that you can change regimes by air power alone. I mean, you can do an awful lot of damage with air power, and you can degrade a capability and so on. But ultimately, use of military force, I mean, there are examples clearly. World War II, in the end, we occupied Germany, and the use of military force against Japan brought the war to an end. But most wars do not come to an end because of military force. They come to an end because people get round a table and negotiate and come to some sort of agreement. And the use of the military is to try to secure the environment within which that can happen. So the Balkans, for example, was a good example of that. We weren't trying to, you know, destroy all of the Serb, Croat and Bosniak military forces. We were trying to hold the peace to secure the environment. The same in Northern Ireland, to try and secure the environment, which the politicians could get round tables and, you know, come to some sort of agreement. And that can often take a very long time. I mean, Northern Ireland, as an operation, literally ran for every year of my commissioned service. Started in 1970 and finished the year I left in 2007. These things take time. And one of the problems with democracy today, I think, is it's too short-sighted and doesn't, you know, think strategically ahead like that. So what's going on in Iran today, I don't think, you know, is going to bring about a change in and of itself. I don't personally think that putting boots on the ground is the right answer. I think change has to come from internally, and you do what you can to support that change. But again, you know, when I was in Iraq, there were lots of exiled Iraqis who were putting a lot of pressure on the president of the United States and others, saying that, you know, the regime was ready to fall and they would bring about change, etc. There was one particular guy called Chalabi, who was, you know, very influential in Washington. But exiled people inevitably, you know, could have a message. They come from a certain perspective. So I don't see the Iran regime changing as a result of this bombing campaign. It's not to underestimate that you can do, you know, you can degrade their capability, and that's not unimportant, degrading their military capability. But it won't solve the problem, in inverted commas. The military, generally speaking, my experience is the military don't solve the problem. They simply provide this environment and help secure an environment in which the resolution has to come through political conversation, narrative around a table.
What about the increasing technologization, the role that technology plays in warfare? Because many people have pointed out, haven't they, how so much of warfare used to be hand-to-hand conflict, and then gradually, as the technology comes, the so-called kill chain becomes longer and longer and longer, and now it seems so much of it is like a computer game, just watching on a screen and using a mouse and clicking a cursor and so on. What does this do to the ethics of warfare, and particularly from a Christian point of view?
Well, it is, I think, serious change. I wrote a paper actually for an organization, a Christian organization, on exactly this subject not very long ago. It was about the ethics of the technologies, about unmanned air vehicles, plus also ground vehicles, and now increasingly by sea as well. We're talking about hybrid, what's called hybrid warfare, and asymmetric warfare. All of which is, as you say, particularly through the AI and the use of cyber and those computer technologies, IT technologies, are reducing the length of these kill cycles, the cycle between finding an enemy position, discovering what's there, deciding whether or not you're going to attack it, and then actually doing so. That was all done by humans, and it used to take, you know, relatively quite a long time. But now with AI and other systems, it can be done very quickly. And of course, what's beginning to happen is that some of it's being done autonomously. And it does create, I think, serious ethical issues. I think there are people who are genuinely worried about it. But it's not easy to see that it was going to stop. The IDF have used a lot of these new technologies in their campaigns, their wars against various Arab nations, particularly obviously in Gaza and in Lebanon. But we're beginning to see these systems coming into play. UAVs are not new, actually. I wrote a master's, notwithstanding my opening gambit, but I got a master's degree in the end in guided weapons. But I wrote my dissertation on use of unmanned aerial vehicles back in 1982. So these technologies have been around for a long time. But Ukraine has really put a lot of oomph behind all of that. And they are, you know, they're serious. I mean, in most wars in the past, artillery has caused most casualties. That's not the case in Ukraine anymore. It's drones and the guided missiles and the use of unmanned aerial vehicles that is causing most casualties in the Ukraine fight.
People have been thinking about the ethics of this kind of weaponry. Often the conclusion has been that you've got to have a human in the chain,
in the loop,
exercising judgment, assessment, wisdom, checking, all that kind of stuff. But it seems that's increasingly being challenged in Ukraine and elsewhere. I mean, do you see, what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think we definitely do need to keep a human in the loop. If we look at, I mean, the whole ethics of warfare is a big issue, of course, but in simple terms, you have the laws of armed conflict, you have the Geneva Conventions, you have rules of engagement, and those rules of engagement will change between theatres of operation, etc. But, you know, all in my time I was serving, they were relatively clear, and it was all about how we individually, as human beings, as commanders, soldiers, sailors and airmen, use those rules of engagement, recognising the laws of armed conflict and the Geneva Conventions. What's been happening is that human in the loop, as people have initially had that human in the loop, interpreting what the drones and UAVs have been seeing, interpreting the reconnaissance that they've found, looking at the data, turning that data into information and knowledge, and that knowledge enabling them as people to make choices and decisions. there's no point in pretending otherwise than that is being challenged. And there's no point in pretending either that I'm afraid people like Putin and President Xi and other, you know, of these leaders couldn't care less about the laws of armed conflict or the rules of engagement. So they will want to take the human out of the loop as much as possible. It's been interesting watching that happen in the context of unmanned UAVs, for example. The RAF were flying UAVs over Afghanistan and using them to attack targets, but RAF pilots were flying them from the, you know, from the bases. But there are lots of people around who say we don't need that anymore. Now, I think we do. I think you need to keep humans in the loop. Otherwise, you're going to have, there's no point pretending technology is going to be 100% correct all the time. It just isn't. I mean, we've seen this in Iran, leave aside anything else. You know, when you target something, the collateral damage, how much it's going to cause, and whether the missile, whatever it is you're using, actually hits the place where you think it's going to hit, that is never 100% certain. And so there's warfare always takes you into places you would not want to go. It's never clear cut. You always end up in situations where, you know, we need human beings to think, hang on a second, this is not going right. We shouldn't be doing that. Let's just pause for a second and reflect on where we're going. But I'm afraid the evidence is that a lot of this technology, as it is in civilian life, is taking us down roads that I'm not very comfortable with.
I mean, we saw a tragic example of that very early on, didn't we, in this current Iran bombing campaign, when the Americans accidentally hit a girls' school that was next door to a naval base they were trying to strike, and reportedly hundreds of children were killed in that. And I suppose, as well as having the human in the loop to try and kind of assess the quality of the AI's targeting, you also want a human in the loop to take responsibility, because fundamentally, if a drone autonomously selects a target, destroys it, and it later discovers that target is actually a girls' school and a naval base, you can't. How do you discipline? How do you hold a drone to account? Whereas if there is a human fundamentally pulling the trigger, there is a person with accountability, both, you know, to the Geneva Conventions, but also, we would believe, ultimately, it has to answer to God for their actions as well.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Now, I don't believe that anybody I don't believe that particular incident you refer to, that anybody deliberately targeted a girls' school.
Of course.
I don't think that happens. But, I agree with you, basically. I don't want to trivialize this, but in a way, it's no different to the conversation about autonomous driving cars. When the autonomous car kills somebody on a pedestrian crossing, who do you hold accountable? So it's the same. It's the same reasoning behind that. And it's not that you always, again, warfare takes you to places you don't want to go. Stuff happens. It's chaos. And actually, part of warfare is, if there's not enough chaos around, you deliberately set about causing it, because you're trying to undermine the enemy and get behind inside their decision cycles and outthink them as well as outfight them. We're always going to end up in situations where we wouldn't want to be there. But you need leaders who are understanding what's going on. The problem is the speed is what's changed so much. Going back to that earlier point, you had time before to think this through. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, people are being put under pressure to make, you know, very, very quick decisions. And that's pretty, you know, it puts people in a very difficult and a dangerous place. Mm-hmm. I was faced with that once, actually. Not to do with missiles and things, but this refugee camp business I spoke about earlier, when I got rung up by the Macedonian foreign secretary, actually, who subsequently became president and was killed in a helicopter crash. But there was a massive buildup on the border of refugees between Kosovo and Macedonia. And somehow this guy got hold of me and said, if I let these people in, because he was coming under a lot of pressure from the international community, can you guarantee to me that you will not allow these refugees, as they would then be, to get into Skopje, the capital, or anywhere else in Macedonia? Because they didn't want a civil war. It sounds harsh, but it was a perfectly understandable, concern they had. Now, my brigade at that stage, along with four armored brigade, were preparing to fight our way into Kosovo. The bombing campaign was going on. Serbia was being hit by NATO bombing campaign, and we thought we were going to have to fight our way in. But going back to the earlier conversation about, you know, becoming a Christian and what that meant, et cetera, it was pretty clear to me that there was a humanitarian crisis blowing up here. And I needed to make what I would argue was the right choice. And I said to him, yep, don't worry. I'd got a clue how we were going to do it, mind, but I said to him, don't worry, it'll be fine. And I went back to the brigade, and we then subsequently built and ran these camps. But for 48 hours, I have to tell you, I could well have been sacked. I mean, I'd made a choice that diverted us away from what most people saw as the principal business, which was preparing this fight. And I think, you know, it's, I mean, I don't say that sort of vaingloriously. That just, I mean, I happen to believe that, it, you know, the guy contacted me because the good Lord had put him in touch with me. There was another guy called Joe Hegenaar who ran the UN High Commission for Refugees, had also been to see me within, you know, within a couple of days of that incident happening. So I happen to believe that the good Lord had been involved in that. But nonetheless, if you don't have a human in that, you won't get that sort of choice and decision being made. It'll be done on some sort of, you know, software, written piece of software, and an autonomous vehicle will just do what it thinks it's designed or been told to do. And I think there's a real danger in that. And we're going to, we will continue to see that, I think, evolving in the years to come.
It's a pretty terrifying prospect, isn't it? Especially this idea that as the AI continues to advance, that people are sort of wargaming, using AI to develop tactics to outthink the enemy. And a lot of it will be about speed and surprise.
Yep.
So how do we as Christians try to be faithful in what seems an increasingly unstable and dangerous geopolitical environment?
Well, clearly there's no easy answer to that, as there is in the world that you are operating in, and in you know, day-to-day civilian world. AI, there, you know, we know a lot of the people who are involved in the development of AI are seriously worried about this in terms of the consequences for humanity in the round, never mind about warfare. And I don't have an easy answer to that, except to say, in a way, I suppose it's not an easy answer, but, you know, we have to make our own personal choices on this. And the choice to become a Christian, to recognize that I need to be standing firm for justice and righteousness, as I said earlier, that I need to be standing firm, trying to seek God's guidance on what it is I'm being asked to do. You know, that enables me to try to make the best choices and decisions that I can. And the, you know, we need more people who are prepared to see that through. I mean, I argue that everybody is a person of faith. They're not necessarily religious faith, but they have a faith. They see the world through the prism of their beliefs, and they make their choices on the basis of those, of that prism. Our prism, my prism, is the prism of Christ. But as an atheist or a humanist, it's a different prism. So when I've had this conversation with people about some of the issues we're talking about, what I've been, you know, an atheist or an agnostic or a humanist will say, oh, well, I'm being true to myself. So their prism is their own prism, if you like. To which my answer is, well, I think Saddam Hussein and Stalin and Hitler and Pol Pot and Milosevic were all being true to themselves. Being true to myself is a very dangerous place to be. You know, I need to be rooted in something deeper than me. And we need people who are prepared to acknowledge and accept the reality of that. And therefore, going back to one of the comments I made earlier, you know, do we want to see an army, air force, or navy where there are no Christians? I do not want to see that position. I want more and more Christians in these positions of power and authority who are able to be involved, make the choices, make the decisions, recognizing that we all get it wrong. We all get it wrong, fail. But nonetheless, the intent is there to do the right thing as we understand it as Christians.
I've got one last question, Tim, before we wrap up. I'm with you in terms of that kind of macro question about Christians in the armed forces. I'm not a pacifist. I don't think Jesus was either. But I guess what I would be worried about, you know, should I be conscripted into World War III or something, is what effect does being involved in this kind of conflict, being responsible for, if we're being blunt, delivering violence to other human beings made in the image of God, what does that do to me as a person? How do we... There's a sense in which warfare is kind of brutalizing to the human soul. And even if we accept it is a sad inevitability and necessity in this broken world, how can Christians in the armed forces kind of protect themselves from becoming changed and shaped by this fairly callous business of war?
Yeah, it is. There's no point in pretending, again, I've used that expression a couple of times, but there's no point in pretending this is not easy. It has an impact. When you see as I said earlier, watching the mass graves being dug, seeing what people do to each other, it has an impact. As you know, to lots of other professions. So my own son works for the National Crime Agency and sees some pretty terrible things. The police forces see terrible things. Doctors, firemen, and so forth. A military force, of course, is a, in a way, I don't know, deeper, bigger, whatever, potentially much bigger, deeper than that. But it does have an impact on people. So I've got no easy answer to this, other than we need each other. We need to have time, space to meet, chat, talk, pray, read the scriptures and so on. I came back from Baghdad in 2003, as I said earlier on, spiritually drained. And part of that reason was I didn't take time out to read the scriptures and to spend time in prayer. It was, you know, life was terribly busy and all of that stuff. So I can give you all sorts of excuses, but it wasn't very helpful. And I should have carved out more time with other Christians. And there were other Christians there as well that I chatted with. The Armed Forces Christian Union, out of interest, is stronger now than it's ever been. It came out of a number of military Christian organizations, including the Officers Christian Union and the RAF Christian organizations and so on. But the serving members of the AFCU is now around 1,400. It's double in the last 10 years. There's about 3,500 people who are members of the Armed Forces Christian Union, many of them retired like myself, but others who are associates who pray for regularly. By what my wife is part of a group who pray for a small number of serving Christians in the Navy, Army, and Air Force on a continuous basis, meeting every month, every 2 months, getting letters, exchanging what these guys would like to be prayed for and praying for them. So the only way we're going to hold against this is through that sort of, meeting, talking, chatting, praying, studying the scripture. But there's no point pretending that it doesn't impact, pretty badly on people. It does. I've got no easy answer to it other than recognizing it. And I think we are better at recognizing it. I'm told, and I think it's true, that more soldiers committed suicide post the Falklands War than actually died in the campaign. So having in place systems that enable people to recognize, PTSD and what they're suffering from and have, people they can talk to, et cetera, et cetera, just in a purely secular sense is much better than it used to be. But it's not perfect. It will never be perfect. And we as Christians, I think, need to recognize the reality of that and work hard, alongside each other, through organizations like the Armed Forces Christian Union to stand alongside people and to help them through the whole process. It's tough. There's no point denying otherwise. It's tough.
Absolutely. I guess this is part of the kind of debt we as the kind of civilian society owe to those who choose to serve in the armed forces. They're taking on some pretty heavy duty stuff on our behalf. I think that's part of something that is important to be cognizant of. We've taken a lot of your time, Tim. Thanks so much for sharing some of your own story and some of your thoughts on how warfare and faith intersect today. All right, thanks so much for your time, Tim. It's been great speaking to you. We'd love to know, listeners, what you made of what we've been talking about. If you've got any questions or thoughts, please do get in touch. You can email us, as always, to molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And as ever, there's lots of interesting things to read on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com, as well. Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming on, Tim. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.